to the hall, the public hall.
Yes, in a way, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Now that's going to be an embarrassing thing.
Yep. In a way, the vote was 7-2. So the two votes was Sharma voted against it and campaigned against it in the limited, 24 hours or 48 hours. And there was another vote by a Democrat who was kind of lukewarm in her support, but she did end up voting against it. But the other ones, including so-called progressives, Democrats, they voted really quickly to do Amazon's bidding and the other big businesses, and they tore it down. So then there was a rally the next day. We got a picture of it here with Sharma speaking, someone from a hospital and so on. A lot of people there supporting she spoke. Here's a quote from just one article from a TV station. Sawat blasts Seattle's council's shameless capitulation on the head tax. Now, head tax is a word that the corporate media like to use to fool people. The way that the measurement of who the biggest corporations, the top 3% of corporations were in Seattle, was based on workers, number of workers. So we called it tax Amazon, the Amazon tax, because that was the biggest corporation. The media latched on, after they thought of this, to a phrase called the head tax. And that made it sound like to workers, each worker would get taxed. Completely false. You're not taxing workers at all. You're taxing a big corporation, their profits, the big profits of a big corporation. So if you hear head tax, this is just big business's propaganda ploy. So Sharma Sawant, Seattle City Council's outspoken socialist member, blasted other members of the council for their shameless capitulation to Amazon and, quote, betrayal of working people, end quote, ahead of the vote to repeal the city's controversial head tax on big business. Controversial only because big business made it controversial. So hard-won victory, Sawant said. Seattle's largest businesses raise money for affordable housing. Other initiatives fight the city's homelessness emergency. Thousands of people are homeless, and many have died this year already, Sawant said. This didn't happen in a day or a year. The city council has presided over this developing homeless crisis for decades. Council President, Democrat Bruce Harrell, sponsored the legislation to repeal the tax at a noon special meeting. It would have cost Amazon and other large companies $275 per employee. That's chump change. They're making billions for the next 5 years to fund $48 million response to Seattle's growing homeless crisis. I think it's per year $48 million, but this implies it's not. The city council passed the measure less than a month ago, but fierce opposition, meaning Bezos wrote some checks, but fierce opposition to this tax led city leaders to rethink the approach. Now, there's one thing I have to say before we get more into that. Money is a material thing, and they started to pour money into this referendum campaign and into propaganda against it. It actually made a huge splash in the corporate media nationwide, and that had the effect of watering down somewhat the support in polling data. Like I said earlier, the polling data was okay, but not great, and it should have been much more than that. And it would have been if they'd taken the poll, weeks before. So here we have three attorneys that claim they are personally against the Amazon tax, but they are filing a lawsuit that accuses Seattle of violating open meeting laws before the head tax repeal vote. This is from an article June 14th from where? It doesn't... a lot of these papers have the print... I've complained about this before. They have their print thing set to... not set in a way that it eliminates the corporate name, and I don't like that. I want to know who published it. The only thing I can tell you, it is Seattle Times, because the author puts their email and it has Seattle Times on. So it's like Lewis Cam, Seattle Times, June 14th. Three attorneys contend that each of the named city officials, these are the ones that voted to repeal, maybe it's all the Democrats, be fined and that their city bear their legal costs. But the lawsuit doesn't ask the council's vote to repeal the head tax be invalidated. So that shows they are for it. Three trial lawyers sue the city of Seattle over the city's council abruptly called special meetings. This is even big business admitting this. And vote this week to revoke a head tax on big businesses. Sorry for that noise in the background. And let's see. Anyway, it's more information, a little too much detail about who the attorneys are and so on. To be clear, the lawsuit does not challenge the legitimacy of the ultimate vote, which it should have. But the public meeting laws appear to indicate that if the court found the council decided to approve its repeal ordinance in secret, have 2 days public meeting, the vote shall be null and void. Huh, that's interesting. So, there's a possibility. I don't know. I don't put any faith in the legal stuff. The vote was 7-2 that it said. Tax on the city's 585 largest business. tax was set to take effect in January. So right now, it looks like they may have gotten their way and gotten this tax off the table despite this legal challenge. But this is a teachable moment because it teaches the true nature of Democratic Party politicians. It's the true nature of American, quote-unquote, democracy. It's all bought and paid for. And to break into that, you have to be a socialist. You have to be independent of corporate funding. And you have to be willing to organize people and not try to keep everything in a back room, you know, and appeal to the better sensibilities of some so-called progressive or whatever. So anyway, check that out in various places, but really mostly to get the truth of it, socialistalternative.org, counterpunch.org, what happened with the Amazon tax. So we're going to take a little break here. This is WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform Commercial-Free Community-Based Radio. And we are also known as 91.5 FM because we go out over the air. It's not just a computer streaming show, not just a podcast. 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. So a lot of different names. We're also known as Tufts Educational Radio. And, you know, we'll take a quick musical break here. Listen to some Clash. Why not?
On the game, but they was murdered by the other team. Went on to win can't be true, you can't be false. You'll be given the same reward. Socrates, a Milhouse, Dixon, folk went the same way through the kitchen. Plato the Greek or in Tintin. Who's more famous in the billion millions? Who's Flash? Vacuum cleaner sucks up fudgy.
That was The Clash.
Guns of Brixton.
And before that, A Clash song that didn't get that much airplay, I don't think, but it should, and you should still play. It's called The Magnificent Seven. They do mention Marx and Engels in this song. And we're about to talk about a film that came out, which we've talked about a little bit on the show, but I hadn't seen it yet. I still haven't seen it, so we didn't get into it too much. It's called The Young Karl Marx by Raoul Peck.
Yes.
Now, my understanding, Raoul Peck is a Haitian director, but now living in Europe. And he did...
And he's left-wing, I know that.
Oh, definitely. Because he did a movie that got a lot more publicity than Young Karl Marx, not coincidentally, because...
He also did, what was that? It's like a document...
That's what I'm talking about. But what was it?
It's I'm Not Your Negro.
By James Baldwin, yes.
Yes.
And he did another film before that that got some...
that one I didn't know about.
Anyway, so... why don't you tell us about it? Because I can't talk about it.
I got it at the public library.
Excellent.
And it was just,
I didn't know it was available. Great.
Yeah.
So that's good news.
Yes.
So that means it's probably for sale in the U.S. too.
Yes.
There was a short period of time where it was only for sale in Europe, and there were pirated copies on YouTube.
Yep.
But you couldn't buy it anywhere.
And you got to keep up with the subtitles because you got to...
So you got it for which library?
French.
Cambridge Library?
Cambridge.
Public Library,
the,
okay.
Minuteman System.
Minuteman System, right. That's a lot of different libraries.
Because we got it from another, like, the guy Arlington or something has it or something like that.
There
so
you go.
They send it to Cambridge, but it's part of the same network.
Right.
So, yeah, you just got to keep up with the, obviously, the, they call it subtitles because it's French. A lot of the scenes are either going to have French, German, obviously, when they're in Germany. In English, obviously, you don't need the subtitles on that one. I just don't want to give it.
No, go ahead. Go say whatever you want about it. That's okay.
It's a great film about young Karl Marx growing up before the basically going through his life or what's happening. Him and Engels. First of all, let's rephrase this: where him and Engels met, and then they started writing like the what was the one? Poverty something.
The Poverty of Philosophy.
Yes, and then eventually the Communist Manifesto.
From what I've read about
the
film...
And it ends at that, so it doesn't, you know, just kind of like, okay, yep. Leaves you with another, what's the word, like, you know, when a film ends and it just tells you what this person did for the rest of his life until death, and, you know... And
yep, like, I don't know what to call that, a summary, a coda?
Yeah, it doesn't, because, you know, it's his epilogue. Young life. It's not, you know, it goes into like, oh, it was epilogue, that kind of thing, you know?
Yep.
It was a great movie. Great movie, Jeff. You definitely got to watch it.
I can't wait. Let me just say what I read about it, because I don't want to pretend I saw it when I didn't, is that, and this sounds like a brilliant choice by the director, he's focusing on a moment where they're moving from, like, sort of activism based a lot on morality, writing based a lot on... you know, emotions, good emotions, but like emotions and sentiment and stuff,
mm-hmm.
to a scientific understanding of the roots of capitalism.
You hit the nail.
Capitalist oppression.
You
yeah.
hit the nail. It yeah. does get and into, capitalism. There's a split within
the Hegelian movement.
Yes, yeah. yes. With, he's a French guy, Proudhon.
Proudhon, yeah.
Proudhon.
Yeah.
Oh, he's in it. And him and Marx kind of have a little ideological, right. you know, right. back and forth.
Right.
I'll leave it at that.
Because Marxism and socialism, if it's certain parts, certain types of socialism.
Because he was an anarchist, wasn't he?
Proudhon
was an Proudhon, anarchist.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
More of an anarchist, yep. wishy-washy, yep. not looking at the dialectical,
the science
behind yep. it. And Marx brought that to that movement.
Because Marxism is a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it based on what you could, I guess, label social science. There's so many variables involved that it's hard to say it's a hard science. But in some, it's based on a lot of hard science. Like a lot of Marxism embraced... when it was being developed, you know, the best science it could find at the time in archaeology and anthropology and, you know, the evolution, the theory of evolution, so-called theory. I mean, it's real. Evolution by Darwin. And hard facts about inequality and so on, but got to the root of the system. How does the system operate? How does capitalism operate? Using dialectical materialism. Dialectical meaning stuff from Hegel, this German philosopher, and before that stuff from Heraclitus and others about things always changing, how things operate on each other to create new processes and new formations all the time, and what's the material basis for that, being things you can measure, things you can, not just ideas. Then ideas themselves come from that dialectic, that materialism. For example, let's just take religion. There's been many, many religions in human history. One of the ones that survive to this day are the ones that had a material force behind them. They had a ruling class using that religion to rule, to propagate the religion through very physical material things like paying priests or whatever, or religious figures, using, you know, building churches, building monuments, you know, having religious armies at times, or using capitalist state or feudal or slave state armies to propagate religions. So that's just what, you know, it doesn't have to be about religion. It could be about anything that people feel are, and a lot of philosophers that are not materialists, they put the ideas first. Now, Marx and Engels, using dialectical materialism, said, well, there's a material basis for all ideas, but sometimes ideas can become a material force if they're backed up by material force themselves. So, for example, that religious example would be a religious idea can become something you can actually measure its support by number of adherents, number of buildings it controls, amount of real estate it controls, amount of propaganda voices it controls through the media. You can measure that. So in that sense, the idea takes on a power, if you want to look at it that way, but based on the material groundwork for propagating that idea. So that's the brilliance of dialectical materialism, I think, that you can put that onto any phenomena. It doesn't have to be political, but it was mainly used for a way of a political analysis and a guide to political action. And so the film is hitting when they're discovering that more explicitly. You know, they were kind of around it, sort of. And there's another funny way to talk about that. They're part of this Hegelian movement, and Hegel talked about dialectics, but not in a materialist way. And he left, for example, he made a mythology out of the state. He claimed that was, he made that sort of religious idea in a way, not religious per se, but like non-materialist, like, yeah. You know, the state is the embodiment of human striving and this and that, a lot of flowery language. So Marx and Engels, who had been part of the Hegelian movement, they basically broke with it. And they printed a little pamphlet called A Ruthless Criticism of Everything in Existence, which is a hilarious title.
La Critique.
Yeah, it's a hilarious title.
There was a part in it.
But it means, the title means that you can apply this method that we're developing, dialectical materialism, to anything. So nothing is above criticism in the sense of analysis, the sense of critical thinking. That's a brilliant statement, and it goes against what Engels was what Hegel was trying to wall off and say, no, this is beyond your criticism, beyond your critical thinking. The state, go ahead.
Yeah, so he did.
Or God,
So Karl Marx and Engels, they did this one work together, and then the wife of, I think it was Marx's wife, says, why don't you just call it Critique of la Critique? It was in French, so.
Yeah, the criticism of criticism.
How do you say that in French? La Critique.
Sounds like the criticism of, the critique of criticism, of the criticism.
Of the criticism.
Yeah, sounds like it.
So I'm saying it because it was in French. So
yeah,
I
understand.
From what I heard.
Yep.
Critique of la Critique.
Mm-hmm.
And he introduced that to Proudhon, and it was
Proudhon,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was just like, you know. Then there was a split. You could see the split happening in the movement at that time. You
right,
know?
Right. Yeah, well, that was a great
part of that film. You'll really like it.
A feature of Marx's time was the split, a continual tension and splitting with anarchists. So the first international that Marx and Engels established to unite the workers' movement in terms of unions and political parties and so on became... And to build a political force that would be international, got mired down into anarchists like Bakunin and so on, rejecting a lot of the theory and methods that Marx and Engels and other socialists and Marxists were putting forward. And that, it wasn't just an academic thing. That would be a thing like, do you engage in, like, you know, anarchist ideas about individual terrorism and bomb throwing and stuff? Do you like the Proudhon thing? Do you really believe that you can have a scientific basis to your ideas? Do you have a coherent ideology at all? One of the criticisms to this day of Marxism has of anarchism is that anarchism seems to be a grab bag of whatever is trendy and seemingly progressive to the anarchists of the day, many of whom then go and vote Democrat and just become liberals, you know, because they don't have a method. They don't learn a method of analysis beyond the sort of realm of that capitalism keeps things in philosophically. So they're idealists at the end of the day. So dialectical materialism is against idealism, not in the sense of idealism in a positive force of I have an ideal I want to fight for, but idealism in the sense of I will look at the world through the development of the world comes from the development of ideas per se. You know, someone thought up a great idea, and that idea then became how the world became the reality of the world. It's responsible for things happening, where base of dialectical materialism is that no, there are things below the realm of thought of ideas that create parameters for ideas, you know, in the human mind, and that thoughts do come from this thing called the brain and not from some sort of floating around in the air somewhere, you know. And these were at that time very controversial, and to this day you would have anarchists that wouldn't believe that. But you do have some anarchists that try to take elements of Marxism and claim them for anarchism, usually in a sort of tactical way, and they kind of distort them, in my opinion, into their ends. So, for example, anarcho-syndicalism would have a lot of class analysis, social class analysis, and critique of inequality and so on. But then it would take unions and sort of inflate them beyond where they can go and what they can do, and say that's all you need to do is radicalize unions. You don't need to have a workers' party. You don't need to have a revolutionary party, all that kind of stuff. So I can't wait to see it. Sounds great. Did you watch it more than once?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I make it a mission to watch it at least five times in a month.
I think what if I want to see it? I hope they have more than one copy floating around the system. You know, what Minuteman.
They got more than one.
I hope so. And
yeah, let's go to Central Square. You know, you're right there next to the Central Square. Yeah. Put it in, even if it's. If they don't have it available, you can put it
I'll
in a
hold line.
On
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I know,
and
I know.
Then it'll be like, oh, you see it on your
that's
email.
How,
you
that's
got
how, yeah. My wife keeps getting Handmaid's Tale through the library, which I started to watch, which is really worth watching. Yep. I really like it. But I unfortunately, we're down to Blu-ray because the other copies are taken, and it's hard. And I won't go into
details.
Oh, so
you got Blu-ray?
No, we don't. Okay. So it's hard to watch Blu-ray. We have to do this fancy thing with the Xbox or anything. Anyway, I don't understand it even. So, Yeah, that's where we're getting all our videos from, is the library, but that's tough. I'd love to own a copy, to be honest, of the young Karl Marx. I wouldn't spend the money right now, but I would in the future if I survive. But there's another movie, and this is going to freak you out. I think you know who this is. You know who Boots Riley is, right? You've heard of Boots Riley? Coup? No? Oh,
the
sorry.
Coup, no.
All right, sorry. I don't know much about Boots Riley's history, so I'm not going to be able to bring us up to speed on that.
Is he a rapper?
Again, I don't want to say. Because I don't know.
Okay.
But this article gives us some information. This is an article from Socialist Alternative by Rob Rook. It's a cultural article talking about a new movie coming out. And have you been to the movies lately, like the theater?
Yesterday.
Oh, nice. What'd you see?
Solo.
What's that? Oh, yeah, the Star Wars. How was it?
Oh.
Was it good?
It was good.
Nice. Yeah, another.
I hated the last one. I wanted my money back. The Last Jedi.
Last Jedi? I missed that.
That was the one with...
Oh, no, I did see that. Yeah, okay.
It was just too much.
It was all right. Yeah, it was okay.
Whatever.
I get it.
But yeah, Solo, that was great. They have to continue that. Okay, make more.
Yeah. There was another person...
Because you know what I like about... What I liked about that movie is that you've seen the poverty, the decreation of the poverty.
Solo?
Yes.
Wow.
So it was more of a criminal element because of their dialectical materialism. The lack of food, the lack of water, the lack of... You know, you can see...
How about young Karl Marx? See the poverty of Europe at that time?
Yes, I did.
Yeah,
in the beginning of it, it's very...
And Marx lived in poverty.
The beginning of the movie is very sad. I don't want to ruin it for you.
His children die,
it gets
right?
Into,
his children die, right, from poverty?
They don't show that.
Sorry.
It just hits a certain...
Some of his children,
Once they did the Communist Manifesto, it stops right there. And that's why I said that epilogue, whatever you say.
Epilogue
of how, you know, his life after that point. Mm-hmm. It's written, and that's it.
Cool.
But when you watch it, let me know what you think of the ending. The ending of it shows everything that we've gone through in the work since his time, World War II, now into present time. So you see a lot of the, he's a brilliant director, the pet guy. He's just brilliant. At the end, he just puts what's happening now from his time. And the end, you know how the end of the movie, you get to see the credits and the music.
Yep.
So he put a lot of what we're going through now with police brutality, strikes. There was one with the strikers in in the 30s with Bill Hayes, getting struck by the police back then. So you had a lot of that up, like dialectical, historically struggles that we've been going through at the end of the movie.
So this is a new movie coming up called Sorry to Bother You. And the headline is Boots Riley Strikes Back at Hollywood. This was written June 12, 2018 by Rob Rook and Socialist Alternative. And, quote, this is telemarketing. Stick to the script is the message shot at Lake Keith Stanfield. So he's a telemarketer. Someone who was in a movie called Get Out and also Atlanta, who plays Cassius Green in Boots Riley's toboggan ride of a first movie. However, Sorry to Bother You, the film, does not stick to the typically sanctioned Hollywood script. Boots Riley, who's African-American in Oakland and lives in Oakland, I believe, was the unofficial leader of Occupy Oakland in 2011. And this guy, the author of this article, by the way, Rob Rook, lives in Oakland, too. And frontman of the left-wing hip-hop
band.
By
the way, that's him. I know who he is. Okay. The coup.
Yeah, I'm going to say that. Yeah,
I lived out in Oakland for a year. That was my favorite group.
Boots Riley, unofficial leader of Occupy Oakland 2011 and frontman for the left-wing hip-hop band, The Coup. So you know their music a little bit?
Yes, I have their albums.
Has directed his first movie, Sorry to Bother You, due for general release in July 2018. So we're almost there, next month. The trailer has several million hits, which I guess you can find on YouTube, Sorry to Bother You trailer, with activists and fans eager to see see if the movie meets expectations. At the recent Bay Area premiere, so it's already been shown once in the Bay Area, Riley, the director, spoke about the current wave of politicization in the Trump era, politicization meaning people getting politicized, interested in politics and so on, the Trump era, and the rise of black cinema. He reminded everyone that movies didn't create this wave, but on the contrary, this increased interest in politics is inspiring filmmakers. The director described Sorry to Bother You as an absurdist dark comedy. It's a comedy. Inspired by the world of telemarketing, the low-paid world where Riley himself worked in his 20s. That's pretty cool. I know people that have worked in telemarketing. I thankfully never had a telemarketing job, but I know people that have. Riley completed the screenplay during the ebb that followed the Occupy Oakland movement. Oakland's Occupy culminated in a general strike in Oakland involving tens of thousands and was backed by a small number of unions, like the longshoremen, before it was brutally forced off the streets by police. Riley was connected to some of the workplace organizing drives that came out of Occupy, some experience of which no doubt contributed to the movie. I don't want to read the whole thing. It's a good article, very long. Most of the reviews coming out of the movie's exposure at the Sundance Film Festival have been positive. However, this is a very important point. Listen carefully. However, Riley has expressed his surprise that while the wild ride and bizarre aspects of the movie have been celebrated in reviews, in other words, the comedic elements, none of the reviews have written about the key central struggle in the film, the workers' struggle for a union and their strike. So these are telemarketers who tried to organize a union, and I don't know if it succeeded or not. I haven't seen the film. But that has happened in real life, too. I know people that were involved in unionizing telemarketing. Sorry to Bother You is simply unlike anything out there. In its form, it's edgy and at times disturbing, but is unique more so in its content. It's an outlandishly spun story. At its core, it's about working people trying to find a way to solve their problems individually and collectively. Like some other movies, it is not soft on the brutality, racism, and narcissism of capitalism, but Sorry to Bother You does something different than usually happens in current cinema. It points its finger towards self-organization, towards unions, towards strikes, towards mass picketing as a way forward, and it does not fail us by having liberalism riding in on the proverbial white horse to save the workers. Boots Riley has made a film for our times. It made more poignant with the current wave of strikes hitting America's schools, like the West Virginia teacher strike and all that. Riley has referenced the poll, and there's a link to this, that finds that a majority of millennials feel more connected to socialism and communism than to capitalism.
Wow.
That's good. This is the audience of millions to whom the movie is aimed. It is not clear if Sorry to Bother You will reach beyond that to the mass audience it deserves, but many, many young activists around the country are counting the days until its release. Now, what do you think? Is it going to be in Boston?
At least.
Because guess what didn't make Boston? Well, guess what didn't make Boston?
But it's going to make it a library system, I assume.
Okay, but guess eventually. Guess what didn't make the theaters around here?
Karl Marx.
Young Karl Marx. Didn't that suck?
No.
That was horrible.
I know.
That was horrible.
I had that. I even went to Kendall One and asked, are you going to ever have, because that's where you, remember we went with Tom to see the Nuremberg trials, whatever, with that lady that, you know, that was the daughter of the guy who actually, you know, did the film.
Yep. And what was their answer?
It's not in our list. let me look further. No, it's not in our list. Actually, it's released, if you like. That's when I went to the library and said, you know what? Let me just call it in.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they had it. It was on, like, a lot of people on wait, but I eventually got it.
I heard it was limited release, and sure enough, I just knew it wasn't going to be in Boston because there was no talk about that.
It was in New York.
Yeah, New York and L.A. A lot of movies only hit New York and L.A. A lot of movies don't even get to the theaters anymore, as you know. They go right to DVD, you know. And yet, it still costs a ton of money to go to the movies. I don't get that. They should be lowering their prices.
Actually, Capitol
like crazy.
Wasn't bad. Yesterday, I went to Capitol Theaters over in Arlington. It was $7. It's over $7.
At night?
It was a 4:10 show.
Yeah, that might be a matinee price.
So, yeah, for $7.
I don't know. I think 10 bucks is too much. I really do. Especially if they're going to charge all that money.
And I brought my own popcorn from outside, so.
Nice.
People looking at me, wait, what? You know, like, he probably said, hey, don't hate me, all right? You should have brought your own.
I brought a backpack into what's that theater chain? It's out.
Regals? Well,
Regals. There you go, Regals. I brought one to a Regals out in the
Brookline
small town. No, this is out in Bellingham, a small town out in Metro West, you know, west of the city. And I got searched, and here I am. I'm in my 50s.
Are you serious?
Man. Yeah, yeah.
When was this?
Yeah. Oh, a few months ago. I haven't been to the movies
lately. Oh, they searched you over there?
Well, they searched my bag, yeah.
They didn't search my bag.
And I'm like,
that was weird.
I stayed calm. I'm just like, I just want to let you, I looked at the manager, looked at me in the face, I just want to let you know I don't really appreciate this. And he goes, it's for security or something. He goes, oh, he said it's for security. Yeah. And I said, then I kind of lost a little bit. I said, I think that's bullshit. I just said to his face. And he didn't say anything. And then he said some other bullshit. And I said something back more calmly. And that was the end of it. I managed to sneak in what I needed to sneak in another way that day, and not my backpack. So that was cool. But anyway, they suck. So anyway, if you want to save the movies, they gotta be cheaper and they gotta be better and et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so I'm wondering if this will hit or not. I don't think it'll hit Boston, but I really hope it does. Pooch Riley has made a film for... Oh, I already read that. Wait a minute. Sorry to Bother You is neither a movie constructed around product placement like so many corporate movies, nor is it written as a blueprint for organizers or the anti-capitalist movement. It's written to unearth the hypocrisy and unseat the powerful. It does not leave us with Hollywood's usual pessimism or its empty optimism. Its conclusion urges us on, like its aggressive driving soundtrack. That's interesting. Sorry to Bother You captures this energy, spirit, and willingness to fight. And we can only win if we fight. So in theaters, supposedly, I added the supposedly, in theaters, July 6, 2018.
So I'm going to look for that. I think his father was a Black Panther member. Because that's where he started.
I don't know.
Oakland.
Don't know.
No, I remember
Charlie.
Living out there,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
For that 1 year in the Bay Area.
Hey, we need to do a...
what's that grill safety one?
Yeah, you like that one? This is a public service announcement here from WMFO, and you want the grill safety one. I don't know if I can find that easily. How about cell phone rights? You want to do that one?
Yeah.
All right. Know your cell phone rights.
I didn't know we had rights with cell phones.
Well, yeah.
What is that all about?
I've seen enough YouTube and cops to know that you don't really have any cell. But anyway, here's what they say. This is from the Electronic Freedom Foundation, EFF.org. And your freedom-loving friends here at WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio, that whether you're taking your cell phone with you on a walk, in your car, or to a civil protest, you should know your legal rights. The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that police must obtain a warrant to search a person's cell phone. However, a phone without a passcode can readily be searched by anybody holding it, and a Virginia court recently ruled that a defendant can be compelled to unlock a device that's protected only by a fingerprint sensor. So consider using a key code password and setting your phone screen to lock very quickly when no one else is using it, particularly if you expect it to be a potentially volatile situation. While the police can't legally force you to unlock your phone, they can ask you to, and if you do that, you've forfeited your rights. The correct answer to a cop's request to search you, your vehicle, or your phone is, quote, "No, officer, I do not consent to a search. Thank you," end quote. Finally, remember that the police can always ask a judge for a search warrant, so think carefully what's stored on your phone, including photos, contacts, and app data. You can learn more about your rights with the Electronic Freedom Foundation on the web at EFF.org. A public service message from the EFF and your freedom-loving friends here at WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. So,
I wish we were back to landlines.
I had a landline tapped on me one time. I could, anyway. That's
back in
story.
The 80s?
Well, here's the story. Back in the early 80s,
and how do you know it's tapped? I'll tell you.
Back in the early 80s, this will be brief. Back in the early 80s, there was a movement by the government to bring back the draft, Selective Service. And they ultimately succeeded, and so everyone that turns 18, if they want college loans and all that, they have to sign this thing for the draft. That's still happening, I think. And a lot of students opposed it at the time. I was going to Boston University, and there was a very quickly movement built against it. And oddly enough, my roommate, who was apolitical, became one of the leaders of this movement, and I was active in it. So, and we shared a phone in an apartment. And it became like a very quick, all-consuming kind of political thing, you know. And it came up fast, campaigned against fast, lost fast, unfortunately. Because, you know, it was had to go beyond the student movement and the civil rights community or whatever you want to call that.
Had to go to working
and it
class.
Never did.
That,
yeah, it
that,
never
the
did.
The people that
yeah.
really
yeah.
suffer.
Yeah. They did it fast, yeah. And, of course, working class people have in the United States are really... really heavily, heavily brainwashed with nationalism, and that includes the military, worship of the military, and so on. So it's hard to get a lot of steam going against, even back then, against something like the draft, even though if it really happened to people, you'd see attitudes change. Boom, like that. Imagine turning 18, the government invoking that Selective Service and bringing back the draft, which they haven't done, right?
Since it's like most countries.
Yeah, but they haven't done it, right? So, I mean, this was 81 or something like that, or 80, 81, 82, and they haven't brought it back, and it's 2018. That's a long time because it was so unpopular during the Vietnam War. I mean, it was the main thing that really spurred the anti-Vietnam War movement, which also led to other movements in the 60s and 70s, mass movements. That's the last mass movement in the United States. And because, I mean, think about it concretely. You turn 18, and you don't control your future. The state all of a sudden controls your future to do a war for the capitalists. And you don't even have to be political. You can just be like, well, I don't want to be killed for something I don't understand or something that feels wrong or for this reason. Maybe you do figure it out. Or you just want your own freedom, you know, to do something else. And, of course, freedom under capitalism is very constricted, but more choices than just going into the army where you must obey an order and you're in prison or you must obey an order and you can be shot or whatever. You know what I mean? That's one of the things that got me when I was in ROTC and considering doing that to pay for college. I've told this story before, but I was politically against it, but I felt like I had no other way to go. And it turned out the union job I had working in various factories was enough money, but I didn't know it yet. So I did 1 year of ROTC, which is voluntary. Then they get you the next year. You have to sign up for real and do 5 years after you graduate. And so I wasn't in that second year yet, so I still like could make a decision. And what influenced my decision was the politics, okay? Left, you know, developing left-wing politics versus the right-wing, or liberal or conservative view of the U.S. imperialism, but also the hierarchy and chain of command is, of course, very strict in the military, and the officers, the ones I had contact with at least, were like something out of MASH. I mean, they were just crazy. So, I mean, literally, not funny crazy either, but like disturbing crazy. Not because they were making us do weird stuff, but because the weird stuff they said. The things that they themselves did, you know, and
do
I felt
they yell
like,
a lot. Do they go like get a
not at that point? They want no, no. This is to train. This is to train officers, and they want you to be a certain way. Boot camp would have been different. I never went through the boot camp. That would have been different probably. Yeah. But even there, they coddle officers a bit in the military, like the Marine, like in the Army. In Vietnam, if you were an enlisted man, you'd say I work for a living. And the officers didn't work for a living. You know, that kind of divide. you know.
Oh, that's...
Yeah, that's true, actually.
It's like management.
Exactly, exactly. The officers are like management.
What do you do other than just walk around
and tell people, wait a minute. This is worse than the management we suffer from. This is management of... They own you. Like, they own you 24 hours a day.
You're a number.
Don't leave the base without permission. Don't do this without permission. Don't do that. And if you do something wrong, you go to prison or you get shot. I mean, they don't shoot people now, but... nowadays, but they can bring that back anytime, you know? Desertion. You get shot for that, right? So, I couldn't imagine obeying every order out of this person's mouth or these people. And one of the things that reinforced that was that you have to sign a piece of paper going into ROTC that if they declare war, you will not declare yourself a conscientious objector. You're signing away your rights ahead of time. And you will go and do the war, and they send these ROTC people. We would just be,
and back then it probably would have been somewhere in El Salvador or,
exactly,
or Nicaragua.
It was, well, remember Panama was soon after I quit.
You would have been
Panama, and then what was the other two? There was a couple other smaller ones,
and Grenada.
Yeah, Grenada, Panama. Imagine me going to Grenada. Yeah, I want to shoot. I want to shoot socialists
Heartbreak
to support
Bridge,
Maurice Bishop.
Ridge,
yeah.
Oh Lord.
Yeah. So anyway,
you're gonna go shoot Cubans? We're just trying to construct.
Exactly. I'm gonna. Are we shooting?
A baseball field. Yeah, come on. Yeah.
So basically,
police action.
Basically, I decided I was against this. I didn't want to continue. I was making enough money through my union job. I didn't need ROTC money to graduate to go through school. And so I go to get my paper that I signed because I didn't like that paper floating around saying I would agree to go to war, even the amount of time I had left, you know, not much time. And the guy said, the major said, oh, I don't know where it is, man. I'm sorry. I don't know where it is.
You signed it?
Of course I did. That was part of to start the program.
So now
The first day they come to you with this paper.
He lost it.
The first day you have to sign this thing to continue. So I continue in the program. Months into the program, I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. But I still have a bit of time to go, and I don't know what happens after that. So I'm like, I want this paper back, because I don't want to get drafted if they bring a draft. I don't want to be able to say I don't agree with the draft or whatever. You know, the conscientious objector is very narrow, but it's something you can use. So, he goes, I lost it. I'm in his office. He says I lost it. So I left, and I went back to my dorm, and I thought about it. I don't really believe this guy, and so I called him next couple days. Oh, I can't find it. Sorry, you know. So then I don't know what, you know, hey, when you're younger, you're a bit impulsive. So on my own, I just went to his office and I said, sat down in front of him and I said, Major, blah, blah, you know, I'm not leaving until you get my CO form or whatever we called it. I can't remember what it was called. And hand it to me. And
all of a sudden, he just hit here.
It's poor computers, by the way. Yeah, so he goes, yeah, all of a sudden, exactly. He just got over his desk. He walked over to a drawer that was about 5 feet from his desk, opens it up, takes it out. Somehow he knew right where it was. Takes it out, hands it to me, and with a smirk on his face. And I go, thanks a lot. I remember what he said, probably something smart ass. And I walk out, I go back to my dorm, I get my friends, I'm like, we're burning this now. We had a little ceremony burning of it, you know? It was funny. It was funny.
That's the only way, huh? Not shred it, just burn it.
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying the point of the story, though, is more like that's true. That's true. But the point of the story is more like the officers having control over your life, even if you believed in the cause, is a bit disturbing. Now, if there was some sort of like socialist army, I would go into it, you know. But I would hope that things were done a little differently, you know, like some democracy or maybe a lot of democracy. So it was disturbing, you know, and I really
Jeff,
feel
the same
bad.
In Cuba. The
I
same
feel
thing.
Bad. I feel
there
bad.
There is no democracy in the. In the military, if you think about it.
Well, I don't know. There could be.
I mean,
I haven't read much about the Red Army in Russia after the revolution, but I know there was a lot of political education to motivate people rather than just coercion or draft or whatever. You had to be a motivated volunteer in that army, basically. Anyway, we're running out of time quick. I'm really glad we got to the movie thing. The other things I had to talk about, movie things, is that a bunch of reports that are coming out at this point trickling out. But you know how like economic crises happen and then you don't really know about them till later in terms of the data and the statistics and all that. Like it was a while before people realized there had been a great recession in 2007, 2008. It was a year or two, you know, even though the effects were felt by people, of course, immediately. So there's a bunch of articles about how the picture that's constantly being painted in the corporate media about the economy right now is just not, doesn't match reality. Even things like unemployment. And it's contradictory data. I mean, I've got one article here where the guy says, yes, it is low unemployment. Part of that, though, is due to people not not being in the system
anymore.
But
they don't talk about the wages.
Though they do sometimes. Well, these articles are alternative.
Making $11 or less.
Yeah, exactly. Well, even the corporate media talks about wages, but there's different signals about that. They're saying now that wages are going up a little bit, and others are saying, no, they're still not. So let's just jump into this real quick. We're not going to be able to, like, come to the conclusions or anything, maybe, but again, this is something by Tyler Durden, and he authored by Michael Snyder via the Economic Collapse blog. I guess it's a column where he put someone else's stuff in. I don't have a citation here that's easy to find. No citation. Great. All right. Anyway, look up the guy's name, either Tyler Durden or Michael Snyder. So every time the mainstream media touts wonderful economic numbers, I just want to cringe. It is true that the economic numbers have gotten slightly better since Trump entered the White House, but the rosy economic picture that the mainstream media is constantly painting for all of us is completely absurd. So he puts out what he says are some honest numbers. He doesn't want there to be a crash, but he's just saying, look, this is really what's going on. He said, we're being told that the unemployment rate in the United States is currently 3.8%, which would be the lowest in 50 years. Let's see. The truth is, of course, that the percentage of the population that is employed has barely budged since the depths of the last recession. So it's a variation of what I just mentioned, that the number of, there's people that drop out of the system that don't try to get jobs anymore or feel they can't or can't, and they're not counted. You have to be in the system, lose the job, then you're unemployed. Then if that runs out and you don't look for another job or you don't get hired, you're not back in the stats. So that's a big problem with this. And we're not, this is somewhat common knowledge with some people that follow this stuff. But so according to John Williams, if honest numbers are being used, the unemployment rate today would actually be 21.5%. 21.5%, not 3.8%, if you count people that number of people working. So what's the reason for this disparity between the two figures? As I've repeatedly explained, the author says, the government has simply been moving people from the officially unemployed category to the not in the labor force category for many, many years. If we use the government's own numbers, there are nearly 102 million working age Americans that do not have a job right now. That is higher than it was at any point during the last recession. We are being conned. I have a friend down in South Idaho that's a highly trained software engineer that has been out of work for 2 years. If the unemployment rate is really 3.8%, why can't he find a job? Now, that's a little tricky because the anecdotal evidence I see around me in Boston area, is that finally I can believe that unemployment is low because I see a lot of for help signs. Do you notice that lately?
I have noticed that.
Oh, it took a while
to
kick
in. Remember, I got laid off from that one burger place, the Woo Burger.
Yep.
Moving on.
Yep.
Getting rehired at Clover because they, whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Don't remind me. Clover. And then leaving there immediately to go to the Blaze Pizzeria / Tahasa where I work between those two.
Yep.
But it's not like, okay, because I've been through it. It's not, I got 40 hours, I'm set, like where I'm at now.
Yeah.
It's retail.
Yep.
It's always fluctuating.
Yep.
They're never steady.
Hold on a second. We're getting a call. I'm going to try to take it. WMFO, you're on the air. Hello? Hello?
She hung up. They hung up.
Okay. Might be someone trying to get in, actually, because we might... I don't know. We'll put some music on in a few minutes, but I just want to get into this. If the call happens again, it's probably someone trying to get in. Sorry for listeners to give you the internal workings here. Some people's IDs aren't working lately. Anyway, so let's see. Then what were we talking about? Anecdotal. But you know what, though? What I was going to say, though, that these signs didn't appear around here of low unemployment until after I'd started quite a gap between after I started hearing there was low unemployment and then actually seeing evidence of it. So there was this big gap in my anecdotal little world view. I'm not basing everything I say on that. I'm just mentioning it. These statistics that he cites our government statistics about people in the workforce. So from that, they're extrapolating what the real unemployment is. So then he goes, next, let's talk about inflation. That's probably what we'll end on. According to Williams, the way inflation was calculated in this country has been repeatedly changed over the decades. And this is kind of common knowledge, too, among activists, in inequality activists or socialists and other union activists and so on. Williams argues that U.S. statistical agencies overestimate GDP data by underestimating the inflation deflator they use in the calculation. This is getting a little wonkish. Sorry about that. Manipulating the inflation weight, Williams argues, in the public comment on inflation measurement, also enables the government to pay out pensioners less than they were promised, obviously, meaning Social Security, by fudging the cost of living adjustments. Now, I'm not going to have time to get more into this because it's getting a bit complicated, but what I will say, based on my own knowledge, is they limit the amount of things they measure for inflation, and they don't hit the things that are most important sometimes to working people. So, for example, it's common knowledge that the cost of a college education has shot up hundreds of percent, you know, or tens of percent, really high over the last decade or more even. And that is like a lot of people want to go to college, or they want their kids to go to college, and that becomes like this huge, huge thing.
Yep.
And there's good statistics on student debt I don't have time to go into that I have here.
What about the statistics of actually people after college getting a job?
Right, right. But what I'm saying is that there's like certain parts of the economy, like healthcare, education. I would add maybe like transportation, and the inflation rate really is shooting up in those areas. And for some reason, that's offset, quote unquote, by maybe food prices that haven't shot up as much, although they're starting to go up really bad right now too. So you got to watch out for the inflation figures. And I already see them gearing up for blaming workers for this. And really, it's not the workers that. Wages that, even if they're going up a little bit, that's only a result of inflation starting already, and they're trying to catch up. So anyway, we have to sort of start to sign off here. And you've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we are here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And what should we leave our listeners with this week?
Power to the people, always.
And
not the few.
I will leave us with check out the tax Amazon struggle and what happened. This is a huge exposure of the corporate nature of Democratic Party politicians on the local level. Usually that's reserved for them at the top, and it's not true. At a local level, they're doing the bidding of big business if they want to survive as Democratic Party politicians. So check that out, and we'll leave you with one of kind of our theme song here. Thanks for listening.
No hell below us. fashion.